on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking National POW MIA Recognition Day with the story of a man who was in captivity as long as just about any American in World War II, 100-year-old Navy veteran Jack Schwartz of Hanford, California.
Let's go back, Jack, right now to when you were captured on Guam. Did you have an idea in your mind, an expectation of what was to come? Because to me, that's the thing that always amazes me about prisoners of war when I hear their stories. Is the uncertainty of it all that they must have felt to not know if you'd ever see home again, not know if you ever see your wife again, not know if you'll even survive. There's no end date on the war that someone can tell you, wait until here and then you'll be free again. I imagine there had to be a million different things running through a young man's mind at that time.
Well, actually, yes, but we never thought that we would win a war eventually, even though things were bad. And we didn't know how long it would take. The Japanese called it 100 years war. Because what they called it the Eastern China Co-Prosperity Sphere. That's what they called it, and which meant that they were going to take over China and all the Orient, really. And we knew it would be that long, obviously. But there was no idea of how long it would take. But a number of the younger fellows, this was while we were prisoners, a number of the younger fellows did get discouraged is the word. And I think some died from discouragement. I really do. Because we all had the same amount of food, and some just sort of gave up. In one of the camps I was at, I was in Yokohama for 2 years after, not at first. We lost about one man a month, I think just from discouragement. They had to work, but they all worked. The officers, incidentally, were not put to work. I think that's the only thing of the Geneva Conference that the Japs honored. I never knew why, but they did. They made us promise not to escape. Well, that was easy. Where we could escape till we were on the island. Actually, it would have been easy to escape from the camp. But where do you go? You're an American in Japan. Who's not going to recognize you? And a few people did try to escape. But they got caught the next day and brought back. Then the whole camp suffered. We had to stand at attention for all night long or something like that.
You mentioned guys dying from discouragement. So that begs the question, what kept you encouraged? What helped you believe that you would survive, that you would get home to see your wife again?
I'm not sure. I just think we have faith that we'd get recaptured. I mean, there's no doubt about it, we'd win the war eventually. As I've said, fortunately, I was not ever really sick. And we all lost weight, but we all wanted more food, but it wasn't to the point where we emaciated. So just had faith, that was all.
And I want to talk to you about some of the conditions of the camps you were in and the way you were treated and what you had to eat and all that. But as far as communicating with your wife back home, was there a point at which you were able to get a letter to her and vice versa? Or were you guys without communication that whole time?
No, actually, we did get to, it was 3 or 4 months after we were captured that the U.S. was notified who the prisoners were. So at least the family knew I was alive. It was quite a bit of time after that when we were each allowed to write a postcard home, which of course was censored, but anyhow, we did write home. And in the course of the whole war, I probably wrote 4 or 5 postcards and got a few letters. I got one package from home. That was about the extent of communication. At least they knew we were alive.
I would imagine, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or impose my own understanding on yours, but I would imagine when you're a prisoner on the other side of the world and you've been a prisoner so long that getting a package from home had to be a real serious highlight for you.
It sure as heck was. It had food mostly and, basically food. They knew that's what we needed. It only happened once. I think they sent more, but I never got them. And the Red Cross sent packages now and then. But in my almost four years, I got one package. And there were more deaths that Jeff was confiscated, that was all. When we got the package, of course, it was a big deal. It had, among other things, butter and jam and some meat. And of all things, a package of cigarettes. And I don't smoke then. I didn't smoke now. And so training went on. I traded a pack of cigarettes for a jar of jam, as I recall it. There wasn't all that much communication, but it was good having even some.
And I'm sure that each camp was different. But when you think back on it all that time, what were the most difficult things that you had to deal with? Were you treated well? Were you abused? How would you describe the way you were handled as a prisoner by your Japanese captors?
Well, the first cab at Sensuji turned out to be just an officer's cab. The Japanese used that for their show cab. If the Red Cross wanted to inspect a Japanese POW cab, they went to Sensuji. It was practically a country club compared to other cabs. So there you have to say that outside of not eating enough, we were not abused, really. In fact, they tried to teach us Japanese, but they gave up after a while. Of course, we learned some things. You had to count off ichi, ni, san, and shi, and so forth. And we learned the commands, turn right, turn left, sit down, you know, things like that. And a little Japanese. But here's something that's interesting. Once in a while, we got Japanese newspapers printed in English. Of course, this was near the beginning of the war, when the Japs were winning all over the place. But we got the news anyway. And even a couple of years later, when I got back to Sensuji, we got one or two copies. And by then, of course, they were losing the war, and their reporting was quite a bit different. But all in all, I've said ever since I came back that as POWs go, I was a very lucky POW. I was beaten a few times in Kawasaki because I was the senior officer there. And if anything went wrong, they blamed me. And I'd get beaten around the face. Not wounded, really, just beaten up till you fall down and they stop. But the interesting thing is that the Japanese beat their own soldiers. A corporal could beat up a private. Just a different culture, that's all. So I'll say again, not only am I lucky to get back, I was lucky the way I was treated, really.
Because in general, Japanese prisoners of the Japanese in World War II had a lot rougher circumstances in most cases than prisoners of the Germans did. But you look at even the longest held POW of the war in Japan, you feel like you were fortunate over there. Were you aware that others in Japanese captivity were being treated in worse shape than you were?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we got stories about them. And, of course, I've read many stories about them since then. This was not in Sensuji, but I went to Kawasaki after about 6 months, along with the other two civil engineers from Guam, and we never knew why. And we guess it was because they shipped some Navy machinists up there. Maybe they thought engineers were machinists. Anyhow, when we got up, I said, oh, it's a mistake, we'll send you back. Well, they sent my friend Frank back after a year, and they sent me back after 2 years, and the third one stayed there through the whole war, and he was killed by American planes about 2 weeks before the war was over. I mean, Bob had hit the cab. So he lived through the whole war, never got home. So as I say, here I was lucky.
And I imagine when you hear a story like that, when you get that news, there's part of you that says, hey, that could have been me.
Well, sure, it could have been. Here's the other thing I was about to tell you. Up at this camp in Kawasaki, we had an English doctor. He was in the English Navy. How he got there is a different story, which you don't want to know about. But he treated the American prisoners, and he got beat up more than I did because he kept on trying to get prisoners excused of going to work. If he tried so hard, he'd get beaten up. He still kept it up. He lived through the war, and later on in 1946, I sent him packages because in England, they were really hard up for months after the war was over. So he got care packages from me as a return favor. But as I say, I've always said I was lucky.
Did
I recommend it.
You wouldn't recommend being a POW for almost 4 years?
That's exactly right.
But that said, I imagine there's a lot of perspective that you've carried forward in your life that you wouldn't have if you had not endured all those years without the freedom that you treasure so much now.
I think so, because things that many people take real serious, and by comparison, they're not serious. And that's been my attitude really long.
Did you ever make friends with any of the Japanese guards or soldiers or officers?
Yes, I did. We had an interpreter at this second cabin in Kawasaki. I forget his first name. His name was Kondo. And we got quite friendly, really. And in fact, he treated us pretty well. We talked, and I had learned in prison camp to do a macrame. I don't know if you know what that is.
Sure.
We got a hold of the string, and I was making macrame wristbands. And the Kondo says, hey, make me one. I said, well, what are you going to do for me? And I knew what I wanted. I had seen in the paper that some bookstore was selling American books on calculus. And I wanted that.
You wanted you're in captivity. Your wife's back in the States. You barely have anything to eat. And what you want to trade for is a calculus book?
What else I could trade for? So I did, and he got it for me. And I worked every problem in the book. I should have saved the book, but I have a good habit. But it helped pass the time. Actually, in my situation, it was boredom more than anything else, because the officers didn't have to go to work. But what else was there to do? You sat around. There were only six of us there.
And when you say some guys died from discouragement, that was probably it, that their minds and that idleness went to that place, and you found some more constructive and productive things to do inside your head.
Well, actually, it was the enlisted men who were at work that died. Interesting thing, though, you were talking about attitudes. 1 year to date after the war was over, two of my friends committed suicide, two that had been in camp with me. So it did have a lasting effect on a lot of people. One was living in a room with me. He was a master sergeant from the Philippines. And the other was a Lieutenant J.G. who was captured in Guam. A very wealthy young man, too, incidentally. They committed suicide a year later, so it must have weighed on him very heavily. I was over it by then.
How'd you do that?
Heck, I don't know.
Well, I want to get to that moment of your liberation and everything that transpired from there, but you mentioned food, and I know you lost 50 pounds or so and got down to about 125, but give us a sense of what you did have to subsist on. What kind of food did they give you? And were there moments where you got something out of the ordinary that you appreciated a lot more than you might say now?
Well, basically the food was soup and rice. In fact, it wasn't always rice. As the war went on, we didn't get rice because some sorts of gravy we didn't recognize, but it was great anyhow. And the soup was mostly vegetable soup. I'm not sure if you know what a daikon is, do you? Mm-hmm. It's a huge white radish. But we had daikon soup day after day after day. And maybe once a month you'd find a tiny piece of fish or meat in it. So the only sick problem I had is I did get beriberi. And in fact, most of the prisoners got beriberi because there was none of the vitamin B in their food. And that beriberi did have an effect on me. It's affected me ever since in my life because it affected my walking. And it used to flare up and disappear. And in the last few years, it has disappeared, so my walking is terrible.
So you told us about the food. You told us how they treated you, that you felt fortunate as an officer to be treated a little better than the enlisted men. How did you deal with not knowing when this war was going to end? And did you ever feel like it should have ended already? This is taking too long? What's going on?
No, actually, believe it or not, I predicted 4 years based on World War One. There's no connection. But somehow that was in my mind. And at our last camp up in Rokorochi, which was very isolated, not even a small town near it. We were up there from June until the end of the war, and the food was no better, and the barracks were even worse. I sent away not so long ago a sketch of the camp that somebody had made. It's in the POW magazines and stuff. And on the upper deck, we each had 22 inches of space. On the lower deck, we each had 25 inches of space. So... that's the way it is. If the war had not stopped, we probably would have frozen up there because they got snow up there all the time, and we had nothing for that. But fortunately, the war did stop.
Yes, that was fortunate for everybody, but especially for you, and it sounds like we wouldn't be having this conversation if it hadn't ended in August of 1945. But it wasn't quite as simple as war ending, Jack finding freedom, Jack coming home. A little more complicated than that. The rest of this prisoner of war's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
From the creators of Courageous and Fireproof comes War Room, a powerful new film about fighting life's battles in prayer.
This is my favorite place in this house. I call it my war room.
Because prayer is a powerful weapon. War Room, now play. Starring Alex Kendrick, Priscilla Shirer, and Beth Moore.
We need an army of believers. Raise them up, Lord. Raise them up.
Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. Tickets and showtimes available now at warroomthemovie.com.